a message to follow. Carefully, she dragged herself through the dirt and mud and rocks until she was far enough away to slip between the trees. She followed Rowan for a ways, the forest growing denser, the rain masking all sounds. She found him standing with crossed arms against a gnarled pine. "There are about 200 mortal soldiers and 3 of those creatures in the caves. There's a hidden network of them all along the shore." Her throat closed up. She made herself wait for him to go on. "They are under the command of someone called General Narok. The soldiers all look highly trained, but they keep well away from the 3 creatures." Rowan wiped at his nose, and in the flash of lightning, she beheld the blood. "You were right. The 3 creatures look like men, but aren't men. Whatever dwells inside their skin is... disgusting isn't the right word. It was as if my magic, my blood, my very essence was repelled by them." He examined the blood on his fingers. "All of them seemed to be waiting." 3 of those things. Just 1 had nearly killed her. Waiting for what? Rowan's animal eyes glowed as they fixed on her.
"Why don't you tell me?"
"The king never said anything about this. He... Had something gone wrong in Otterlin? Had Kaol somehow told the king who and what she was, and the king sent these men here to... No. It had to have taken weeks, months to get these creatures smuggled here. Send word for Wendland's forces. Warn them right now.
Even if I reached Vera's tomorrow, it would take over a week to get here on foot. Most of the units have been deployed in the north all spring.
We still need to warn them that they're at risk.
Use your head. There are endless caves and places to hide along the western coastline. And yet they pick here, this access point.
She visualized the map of the area. The mountain road will take them past the fortress. Her blood chilled, and even her magic, flickering in an attempt to soothe her, could not warm her, as she said,
"No, not past. To the fortress. They're going after the Demi-Fae."
A slow, grave nod.
"I think those bodies we found were experiments. To learn the weaknesses and strengths of the Demi-Fae. To learn which ones were compatible with whatever it is they do to warp beings. With these numbers, I'd suggest this unit was sent here to capture and retrieve the Demi-Fae, or to wipe out a potential threat.
Because if they could not be converted and enslaved to Otterlin, then the Demi-Fae could be convinced to potentially fight for Wendland in a war.
They could be the strongest warriors in Wendland's forces, and cause more than a bit of trouble for Otterlin as a result."
She lifted her chin and said,
"Then right now. Right now we'll go down to that beach and unleash our magic on them all. While they're sleeping."
She turned, even as part of her soul started bucking and thrashing at the thought of it. Rowan grabbed her elbow.
"If I had thought there was a way to do it, I would have suffocated them all. But we can't, not without endangering our lives in the process."
"Believe me, I can and I will." They were Otterlin's soldiers. They had butchered and pillaged and done more evil than she could stomach. She could do it. She would do it.
"No. You physically cannot harm them, Aelin, not right now. They know enough about those word marks to have protected their whole rutting camp from our kind of magic. Wards, like the stones around the fortress, but different. They wear iron everywhere they can, in their weapons, in their armor. They know their enemy well. We might be good, but we can't take them on alone and walk out of those caves alive.
Selena paced, running her hands through her rain-wet hair, and then realized he hadn't finished.
Say it, she demanded.
Narok is in the very back of the caves, in a private chamber. He is like them, a creature wearing the skin of a man. He sends out his three monsters to retrieve the demi-fae, and they bring them back to the cave for him to experiment on.
She knew then why Rowan had moved her into the trees, far from the beach. Not for safety, but because
there was a demi-fae in there right now. I tried to cut off her air, to make it easier for her,
Rowan said.
But they have her in too much iron, and she won't make it through the night even if we go in there now. She is already a husk, barely able to breathe. There is no coming back from what they've done. They've fed on the very life of her, trapping her in her mind, making her relive what horrors and miseries she'd already encountered.
Even the fire in her blood froze. If it truly fed on me that day in the barrows, she whispered. If I hadn't managed to escape, it would have drained me like that.
A low, confirming growl rippled out of Rowan. Nauseated, Selena scrubbed at her face, tipped her head back to the rain trickling in from the canopy above, then finally took a long breath and faced Rowan.
We cannot kill them with our magic while they are encamped. Wendelin's forces are too far away, and Narok is going after the demi-fae with three of those monsters plus 200 soldiers.
She was thinking aloud, but Rowan nodded anyway.
How many of the sentries at Mistward have actually seen battle?
30 or less, and some, like Malachi, are too old, but will fight anyway, and die.
Rowan walked deeper into the woods. She followed him, if only because she knew if she took one step closer to the beach, she would go after that female. From the tension in Rowan's shoulders, she knew he felt the same. The rain ceased, and Selena pulled back her hood to let the misty air soak into her too hot face. This area was full of shepherds and farmers and fishermen. Aside from the demi-fae, there was no one else to fight the creatures. They had no advantage, save for knowing their territory better than their enemy. They would send word to Wendelin, of course, and maybe help would arrive in the next week. Rowan held up a fist, and she halted as he scanned the trees ahead and behind. With expert quietness, he unsheathed one of the blades in his vambraces. The smell hit her a second later, the stench of whatever those creatures were beneath the mortal meat.
Only one.
He was so quiet she could hardly hear, even with her fey ears. That's not reassuring, she said with equal softness, drawing her own dagger. Rowan pointed.
He's coming dead at us. You head to the right for 20 yards. I'll go left. When he's between us, wait for my signal, then strike. No magic. It might attract too much attention if others are nearby. Keep it quick and quiet and fast.
Rowan, this thing?
Quick and quiet and fast.
His green eyes flashed, but she held his stare. It fed on me and would have turned me into a husk, she silently said. We could easily meet that fate right now.
You were unprepared, he seemed to say, and I was not with you.
This is insane. I faced one of the defective ones, too, and it almost killed me.
Scared, princess?
Yes, and wisely so.
But he was right. These were their woods, and they were warriors. This time it would be different. So she nodded, a soldier accepting orders, and did not bother with farewells before she slipped into the trees. She made her footfalls light, counting the distance, listening to the forest around them, keeping her breathing steady. She ducked behind a mossy tree and drew her other blade. The smell deepened into a steady reek that made her head pound. As the clouds overhead cleared further, the starlight faintly illuminated the low-lying mist on the loamy earth. Nothing. She was starting to wonder whether Rowan had been mistaken, when the creature appeared between the trees ahead, closer to her than she'd anticipated. Much, much closer. She felt him first, the smudge of blackness, the silence that enveloped him like an extra cloak. Even the fog seemed to pull away from him. Beneath his hood, she could only glimpse pale skin and sensual lips. He did not bother with weapons, but it was his nails that made her breath catch. Long, sharp nails that she remembered all too well. How they'd felt when they ripped into her in the library. Unlike those nails, these were unbroken, the polished black curves gleaming. The skin on his fingers was bone white and flawless, too smooth to be natural. Indeed, she could have sworn she saw dark, glittering veins, a mockery of the blood that had once flowed there. Selena didn't dare bat an eyelash as the thing turned his hooded head toward her. Rowan still didn't give the signal. Did he realize how close it was? A wet trickle of warmth flowed onto her lips from one of her nostrils. She tensed, bracing herself, and wondered how fast he could move and how deeply she would have to slice with her long knives. The sword would be a last resort, as it was more cumbersome. Even if using the knives meant getting in close. He scanned the trees, and Selena pressed behind hers. The creature beneath the library had torn through metal doors as if they were curtains, and it knew how to use the word marks. She glanced out in time to see him step toward her tree, the movement deadly elegant, and promising a long, painful end. He had not had his mind broken. He still retained the ability to think, to calculate. These things were so good at their work, it seemed that the king had thought only three were necessary here. How many others remained hidden on her continent? The forest had fallen so still that she could hear a huffing sound. He was scenting her. Her magic flared, and she shoved it down. She didn't want her magic touching this thing, with or without Rowan's command. The creature sniffed again and took another step in her direction. Just like that day at the Barrows, the air began to hollow out, pulsing against her ears. Her other nostril began to bleed. Shit. The thought hit her then, and the world stumbled. What if it had gotten to Rowan first? She dared another glance around the tree. The creature was gone. Chapter 47. Selena silently swore, scanning the trees. Where in hell had the creature gone? The rain began again, but the dead scent still clung to everything. She lifted her long dagger to angle it in Rowan's direction, to signal him to indicate whether he was breathing. He had to be. She would accept no other alternative. The blade was so clean she could see her face in it, see the trees and the sky and the creature now standing behind her. Selena pivoted, swiping for its exposed side, one blade angled to sink straight into its ribs, the other slashing for the throat, a move she'd practiced for years and years, as easy as breathing. but its black, depthless eyes met hers. And Selena froze. In her body, her mind, her soul. Her magic sputtered and went out. She scarcely heard the damp thud of her blades hitting the earth. The rain on her face dulled to a distant sensation. The darkness around them spread, welcoming, embracing, comforting. The creature pulled back the cowl of its cloak. The face was young and male, unearthly perfection. Around his neck, a torque of dark stone. Wordstone, she vaguely recalled, gleamed in the rain. This was the god of death incarnate. It was not with any mortal man's expression or voice that he smiled and said, "You." She couldn't look away. There were screams in the darkness, screams she had drowned out for so many years, but now they beckoned. His smile widened, revealing two white teeth, and he reached a hand for her throat. So gentle, those icy fingers, as his thumb brushed her neck, as he tilted her face up to better stare into her eyes. "Your agony tasted like wine," he murmured, peering into the core of her. Wind was tearing at her face, her arms, her stomach, roaring her name. But there was eternity and calm in his eyes, a promise of such sweet darkness, and she could not look away. It would be a blessed relief to let go. She needed only surrender to the dark, just as he asked. "Take it," she wanted to say, tried to say. "Take everything." A flash of silver and steel pierced the inky veil. And another creature, a monster made of fangs and rage and wind, was there, ripping her away. She clawed at him, but he was ice. He was Rowan. Rowan was hauling her away, shouting her name, but she couldn't reach him, couldn't stop that pull toward the other creature. Teeth pierced the spot between her neck and shoulder, and she jerked, latching onto the pain as if it were a rope yanking her out of that sea of stupor. Up, up, until Rowan crushed her against him with one arm, sword out, her blood dripping down his chin as he backed away from the creature that lingered by the tree. Pain. That was why the body that morning had been marred. The demi-fae had tried to use physical pain to break free of these things, to remind the body of what was real and not real. The creature huffed a laugh. Oh, gods, it had placed her in its thrall. That swiftly, that easily. She hadn't stood a chance, and Rowan wasn't attacking because in the dark, with limited weapons against an enemy who did not need blades to kill them, even Rowan was outmatched. A true warrior knew when to walk away from a fight. Rowan breathed. "We have to run." There was another low laugh from the creature, who stepped closer. Rowan pulled them farther back. "You can try," it said in that voice that did not come from her world. That was all Selena needed to hear. She flung out her magic. A wall of flame sprang up as she and Rowan sprinted away, a shield into which she poured every ounce of will and horror and shame, damning the consequences. The creature hissed, but she didn't know if it was due to the light stinging its eyes or merely frustration. She didn't care. It bought them time, a whole minute hurtling uphill through the trees. Then crashing came from behind, that reeking stain of darkness spreading like a web. Rowan knew the woods, knew how to hide their trail. It bought them more time and distance. The creature stalked them, even as Rowan used his wind to blow their scent away. Mile after mile they ran, until her breath was like shards of glass in her lungs, and even Rowan seemed to be tiring. They weren't going to the fortress. No, they wouldn't lead this thing within 10 miles of there. Rather, they headed into the Cambrian Mountains, the air growing chilled, the hills steeper. Still, the creature followed.
He won't stop, Selena panted, as they hauled themselves up a harrowing incline, almost on all fours.
She pushed against the urge to fall to her knees and vomit.
He's like a hound on a scent.
Her scent. Far below, the thing prowled after them. Rowan bared his teeth, rain sluicing down his face.
Then I'll run him down until he drops dead.
Lightning illuminated a deer path atop the hill.
Rowan, she panted. Rowan, I have an idea.
Selena wondered if she still had a death wish, or perhaps the god of death just liked to play with her too much. It was another uphill trek to the trees whose bark had been skinned off. And then she made herself a merry fire and burned a torch beside a forgotten road, the light shining through those skinless trees. Far below, she prayed that Rowan was keeping the creature occupied the way she'd told him to, leading it in circles with the scent on her tunic.
Scree,
went the wedding stone down her dagger as she perched atop a large rock. Despite her incessant trembling, she hummed as she sharpened, a symphony she'd gone to see performed in Rifthold every year until her enslavement. She controlled her breathing and focused on counting the minutes, wondering how long she could remain before she had to find another way.
Scree.
A rotting scent stuffed itself up her nose, and the already quiet forest went still.
Scree.
Not her own blade sharpening, but another's. Almost in answer to her own. She sagged in relief and ran the wedding stone down her dagger one more time before standing, willing strength to her knees. She did not allow herself to flinch when she beheld the five of them standing beyond the skinned trees, tall and lean and bearing their wicked tools.
Run, her body screamed, but she held her ground, lifted her chin, and smiled into the dark.
I'm glad you received my invitation.
Not a hint of sound or movement.
Your four friends decided to come uninvited to my last campfire, and it didn't end well for them.
But I'm sure you know that already. Another one sharpened his blades, firelight shivering on the jagged metal.
Fey bitch, we'll take our sweet time with you.
She sketched a bow, even though her stomach was heaving at the reek of carrion, and waved her torch as if it were a baton at what awaited below.
Oh, I certainly hope you do, she said.
Before they could surround her, she burst into a sprint. Selena knew they were near not because of the crashing brush or the whip of their blades through the air, but from the stench that tore gnarled fingers through her senses. Clutching her torch in one hand, she used the other to keep herself aloft as she bounded down the steep road, dodging rocks and brambles and loose stones. It was a mile down to where she'd told Rowan to lead the creature, a mad flight through the dark. Ankles and knees barking in protest, she leapt and ran, the skinwalkers closing in around her like wolves on a deer. The key was not to panic. Panic made you stupid. Panic got you killed. There was a piercing cry, a hawk screech. Rowan was exactly where they'd planned, the king's creature perhaps a minute behind and slinking through the brush. Right by the creek, where she dumped her torch. Right where the road curved around a boulder. The ancient road went one way, but she went another. A wind shoved past, going in the direction of the road. She threw herself behind a tree, a hand over her mouth to keep her jagged breaths contained as the wind pushed her scent away. A heartbeat later, a hard body enveloped hers, shielding and sheltering.
and then the 5 pairs of bare feet slithered along the road, after the scent that now darted and hurtled down, down to the creature running right at them. She pressed her face into Rowan's chest. His arms were solid as walls, his assortment of weapons just as reassuring. At last, he tugged at her sleeve, nudging her upward, to climb. In a few deft movements, she hauled herself up the tree to a wide branch near its top. A moment later, Rowan was behind her, sitting against the trunk. He pulled her against him, her back to his chest as he folded his arms around her, hiding her scent from the monsters raging below. A minute passed before the screaming began, bleeding shrieks and shouts and roars of 2 different sets of monsters who knew death was upon them, and the face it bore was not kind. For the better part of 30 minutes, the creatures fought in the rainy dark until those wretched shrieks turned victorious and the unearthly roars sounded no more. Selena and Rowan held tight to each other and did not dare close their eyes for the entirety of the night. Chapter 48. There was no uproar, no hysteria when they told the fortress what they'd discovered. Malachi immediately dispatched messengers to Wendland's king to beg for help, to the other demi-fae settlements to order those who could not fight to flee, and to the healer's compound to help every single patient who was not bedbound evacuate. Messengers returned from the king, promising as many men as could be spared. It was a relief, Selena thought, but a bit of a terror, too. If Galen showed up, if any of her mother's kin arrived here. She wouldn't care, she told herself. There were bigger matters at hand. And so she prayed for their swift arrival and prepared with the rest of the fortress's residents. They would face the threat head-on, starting by taking out the 200 mortal soldiers that accompanied Narok and his 3 creatures as soon as they left their protected caves. Rowan seized control of the fortress with no fuss, only gratitude from the others, actually. Even Malachi thanked the prince, as Rowan set about organizing rotations, delegating tasks, and planning their survival. They had a few days until reinforcements arrived and they could launch their assault. But should their enemy march sooner, Rowan wanted them slowed down and incapacitated as much as possible until help arrived. The demi-fae were not an army and did not have the resources of a fully stocked fortress, so Rowan declared they'd make do with what they did possess, their wits, determination, and knowledge of the terrain. From the sound of it, somehow the skinwalkers had brought down one of the creatures, so they weren't truly invincible. But without a body the following morning, they hadn't learned how it had been killed. Rowan and Selena went out with the small groups that were preparing the forest for the attack. If Narok's force was going to take the deer path to sack the fortress, then they'd find themselves taking it through pitfall-laden territory, through glens of venomous creatures, over concealed holes full of spikes, and into snares at every turn. It might not kill them, but it would slow them down enough to buy more time for aid to come. And should they wind up under siege, there was a secret tunnel leading out of the fortress itself, so ancient and neglected that most of the residents hadn't even known it existed until Malachi mentioned it. It was better than nothing. A few days later, Rowan assembled a small group of captains around a table in the dining hall.
Bass's scouting team reported that the creatures look like they're readying to move in a few days, he said, pointing to a map. Are the 1st and 2nd miles of traps almost done?
The captains gave their confirmation.
Good. Tomorrow I want your men preparing the next few miles, too.
Standing beside Rowan, Selena watched as he led them through the meeting, keeping track of all the various legs and arms of their plan, not to mention remembering all the names of the captains, their soldiers, and what they were responsible for. He remained calm and steady, fierce even, despite the hell that might soon be upon them. Glancing at the demi-fae assembled, their attention wholly on Rowan, she could see that they clung to that steadiness, that cold determination and clever mind, and centuries of experience. She envied him for it. And beneath that, with a growing heaviness she could not control, she wished that when she left this continent, she wouldn't go alone.
"Get some sleep. You're no use to me completely dazed."
She blinked. She'd been staring at him. The meeting was over, the captains already walking away to attend to their various tasks.
"Sorry."
She rubbed her eyes. They'd been up since before dawn, readying the last few miles of path, checking that all the traps were secure. Working with him was so effortless. There was no judgment, no need to explain herself. She knew no one would ever replace Nehemia, and she never wanted anyone to. But Rowan made her feel better, as if she could finally breathe after months of suffocating. Yet now, he was still watching her, frowning.
"Just say it."
She examined the map on the table between them. "We can handle the mortal soldiers, but those creatures and Narok. If we had fae warriors, like your companion who came to receive his tattoo..." She didn't think calling him Rowan's kitty cat friend would help her case this time. "Or all five of your cadre, even. It could turn the tide." She traced the lines of mountains that separated these lands from the immortal ones beyond. "But you have not sent for them. Why?"
"You know why."
"Would Maeve order you home out of spite for the demi-fae?" His jaw tightened.
"For a few reasons, I think."
"And this is the person you chose to serve?"
"I knew what I was doing when I drank her blood to seal the oath."
"Then let's hope Wendland's reinforcements get here quickly." She pursed her lips and turned to go to their room. He gripped her wrist.
"Don't do that."
A muscle feathered in his jaw.
"Don't look at me like that."
"Like what?"
"With that disgust."
"I'm not..." But he gave her a sharp look. She sighed. "This? All this, Rowan." She waved a hand to the map, to the doors that the demi-fae had passed through, to the sounds of people readying their supplies and defenses in the courtyard. "For whatever it's worth, all of this just proves that she doesn't deserve you. I think you know that, too." He looked away.
"That isn't your concern."
"I know. But I thought you should still hear it." He didn't respond, wouldn't even meet her eyes, so she walked away. She looked over her shoulder once, to find him still hunched over the table, hands braced on its surface, the powerful muscles of his back visible through his shirt. And she knew he wasn't looking at the map. Not really. But saying that she wished he could return with her to Otterlin, to Terrasen, was pointless. He had no way to break his oath to Maeve, and she had nothing to entice him with, even if he could. She was not a queen. She had no plans to be one. And even if she had a kingdom to give him if he were free, telling him all that was useless. So she left Rowan in the hall. But it did not stop her from wishing she could keep him. The next afternoon, after washing her face and bandaging a burn on her forearm in Rowan's room, Selena was just coming down to help with the dinner preparations when she felt, rather than heard, the ripple of silence through the fortress. deeper and heavier than the nervous quiet that had hovered over the compound the last few days. The fortress had not been this tense since that first night Maeve had been here. It was too soon for her aunt to be checking on her. She had little to show so far other than a few somewhat useful tricks and her various shields. She took the stairs two at a time until she reached the kitchen. If Maeve learned about the invasion and ordered Rowan to leave, breathing, thinking, those were the key tools to enduring this encounter. The heat and yeasty scent hit her as she bounded down the last steps, slowing her gait, lifting her chin, even though she doubted her aunt would condescend to meet in the kitchen, unless she wanted her unbalanced. But Maeve was not in the kitchen. Rowan was, and his back was to her as he stood at the other end with Emrys, Malachi, and Luca, talking quietly. Selena stopped dead as she beheld Emrys's too pale face, the hand gripping Malachi's arm. As Rowan turned to her, lips thin and eyes wide with shock and horror and grief, the world stopped dead too. Rowan's arms hung slack at his sides, his fingers clenching and unclenching. For a heartbeat, she wondered if she went back upstairs, whatever he had to say would not be true. Rowan took a step toward her. One step. And that was all it took before she began shaking her head, before she lifted her hands in front of her as if to push him away. "Please," she said, and her voice broke. "Please." Rowan kept approaching, the bearer of some inescapable doom, and she knew that she could not outrun it, and could not fall on her knees and beg for it to be undone. Rowan stopped within reach, but did not touch her, his features hardening again. Not from cruelty, because he knew, she realized, that one of them would have to hold it together. He needed to be calm. He needed to keep his wits about him for this. Rowan swallowed once. Twice.
There was an uprising at the Calicala labor camp, he said.
Her heart stumbled on a beat.
After Princess Nehemia was assassinated, they say a slave girl killed her overseer and sparked an uprising. The slaves seized the camp.
He took a shallow breath.
The King of Otterland sent 2 legions to get the slaves under control. And they killed them all.
The slaves killed his legions? A push of breath. There were thousands of slaves in Calicala. All of them together would be a mighty force, even for 2 of Otterland's legions. With horrific gentleness, Rowan grasped her hand.
No. The soldiers killed every slave in Calicala.
A crack in the world, through which a keening wail pushed in like a wave.
There are thousands of people enslaved in Calicala.
The resolve in Rowan's countenance splintered as he nodded. And when he opened and closed his mouth, she realized it was not over. The only word she could breathe was,
"Endovier?"
It was a fool's plea. Slowly, so slowly, Rowan shook his head.
Once he got word of the uprising in Ilway, the King of Otterland sent 2 other legions north. None were spared in Endovier.
She did not see Rowan's face when he gripped her arms as if he could keep her from falling into the abyss. No. All she could see were the slaves she'd left behind, the ashy mountains and those mass graves they dug every day, the faces of her people who had worked beside her, her people whom she had left behind, whom she had let herself forget, had let suffer, who had prayed for salvation, holding out hope that someone, anyone would remember them. She had abandoned them, and she had been too late. Nehemia's people, the people of other kingdoms, and her people, the people of Terrasen, the people her father and mother and court had loved so fiercely. There had been rebels in Endovir, rebels who fought for her kingdom when she had been. There were children in Endovir, in Calicala. She had not protected them. The kitchen walls and ceiling crushed her, the air too thin, too hot. Rowan's face swam as she panted, faster and faster. He murmured her name too softly for the others to hear. And the sound of it, that name that had once been a promise to the world, the name she had spat on and defiled, the name she did not deserve. She tore off his grip, and then she was walking out the kitchen door, across the courtyard, through the ward stones, and along the invisible barrier, until she found a spot just out of sight of the fortress. The world was full of screaming and wailing, so loud she drowned in it. Selena did not utter a sound as she unleashed her magic on the barrier, a blast that shook the trees and set the earth rumbling. She fed her power into the invisible wall, begging the ancient stones to take it, to use it. The wards, as if sensing her intent, devoured her power whole, absorbing every last ember until it flickered, hungry for more. So she burned and burned and burned. Chapter 49. For weeks now, Kaol hadn't had any contact with any of his friends, allies, whatever they had been. So one last time, Kaol slipped into the rhythm of his old duties, though it was more difficult than ever to oversee the king's luncheons, though making his reports was an effort of will. He did it. He had heard nothing from Adian or Wren, and still hadn't yet asked Dorian to use his magic to test out their theories about the spell. He was starting to wonder if he was done playing his part in Adian's growing rebellion. He'd gathered enough information, crossed enough lines. Perhaps it was time to learn what could be done from Aniel. He would be closer to Morath, and maybe he could uncover what the king was brewing down there. The king had accepted his plans to take up his mantle as heir to Aniel with hardly any objections. Soon he was to present options for a replacement. Kaol was currently standing guard at a state luncheon in the Great Hall, which Adian and Dorian were both attending. The doors had been thrown open to welcome in the spring air, and Kaol's men were standing at each one, weapons at the ready. Everything was normal. Everything was going smoothly. Until the king stood, his black ring seeming to gobble up the midday sun streaming in through the towering windows. He lifted a goblet, and the room fell silent. Not in the way it did when Adian spoke. Kaol hadn't been able to stop thinking about what the general had said to him, about choosing a side. Or what Dorian had said, about his refusal to accept Selena and the prince for what they really were. Over and over again, he'd contemplated it. But nothing could prepare Kaol, or anyone in that silent hall, as the king smiled to the tables below his dais and said, "Good news arrived this morning from Eilwey and the north. The Calicala slave rebellion has been dealt with." They'd heard nothing of it, and Kaol wished he could cover his ears as the king said, "We'll have to work to replenish the mines, there and in Endovir, but the rebel taint has been purged." Kaol was glad he was leaning against a pillar. It was Dorian who spoke, his face bone white. "What are you talking about?" His father smiled at him. "Forgive me.
It seems the slaves in Calicalla got it into their heads to start an uprising after Princess Nehemia's unfortunate death. We got it into our heads not to allow it, or any other potential uprisings. And as we didn't have the resources to devote to interrogating each and every slave to weed out the traitors,
Kaol understood what strength it took for Dorian not to shake his head in horror, as he did the calculations, and understood just how many people had been slaughtered.
General Ash River,
the king said. Adian sat motionless.
You and your Bane will be pleased to know that since the Purge in Andovir, many of the rebels in your territory have ceased their antics. It seems they did not want a fate similar to that of their friends in the mines.
Kaol didn't know how Adian found the courage and will. But the general smiled and bowed his head.
Thank you, Majesty.
Dorian burst into Sorsha's workroom. She jumped from her spot at the table, a hand on her chest.
Did you hear?
He asked, shutting the door behind him. Her eyes were red enough to suggest that she had. He took her face in his hands, pressing his brow against hers, needing that cool strength. He didn't know how he kept from weeping or vomiting or killing his father on the spot. But looking at her, breathing in her rosemary and mint scent, he knew why.
I want you out of this castle, he said. I'll give you the funds, but I want you away from here as soon as you can find a way to go without raising suspicion.
She yanked out of his grasp.
Are you mad?
No. He'd never seen anything more clearly.
If you stay, if we are caught, I will give you whatever money you need.
No money you offer could convince me to leave.
I'll tie you to a horse if I have to. I'm getting you out.
And who will look after you? Who will make your tonics? You're not even talking to the captain anymore. How could I leave now?
He gripped her shoulders. She had to understand. He had to make her understand. Her loyalty was one of the things he loved. But now, it would only get her killed.
He murdered thousands of people in one sweep. Imagine what he'll do if he finds you've been helping me. There are worse things than death, Sorsha. Please, please just go.
Her fingers found his, entwining tight.
Come with me.
I can't. It will get worse if I leave, if my brother is made heir. And I think I know of some people who might be trying to stop him. If I am here, perhaps I can help them in some way.
Oh, Kaol. He understood completely now why he had sent Selena to Wendlin. Understood that his return to Aniel. Kaol had sold himself to get Selena to safety.
If you stay, I stay, Sorsha said. You cannot convince me otherwise.
Please,
he said. Because he didn't have it in him to yell. Not with the deaths of those people hanging over him.
Please.
But she brushed her thumb across his cheek.
Together. We'll face this together.
And it was selfish and horrible of him. But he put up no further argument. Kaol went to the tomb for privacy. To mourn. To scream. But he was not alone. Adian was sitting on the steps of the spiral stairwell, his forearms braced on his knees. He didn't turn as Kaol set down his candle and sat beside him.
What do you suppose?
Adian breathed, staring into the darkness.
The people on other continents, across all those seas, think of us. Do you think they hate us or pity us for what we do to each other? Perhaps it's just as bad there. Perhaps it's worse. but to do what I have to do. To get through it. I have to believe it's better. Somewhere it's better than this.
Kaol had no answer.
I have...
Adian's teeth gleamed in the light.
I have been forced to do many, many things. Depraved, despicable things. Yet nothing made me feel as filthy as I did today, thanking that man for murdering my people.
There was nothing he could say to console him. Nothing he could promise. So Kaol left Adian staring into the darkness. There was not one empty seat in the Royal Theater that night. Every box and tier was crammed with nobility, merchants, whoever could afford the ticket. Jewels and silk gleamed in the light of the glass chandeliers, the riches of a conquering empire. The news about the slave massacres had struck that afternoon, spreading through the city on a wave of murmuring, leaving only silence behind. The upper tiers of the theater were unusually still, as if the audience had come to be soothed, to let the music sweep away the stain of the news. Only the boxes were full of chatter about what this meant for the fortunes of those seated in the plush crimson velvet chairs, debates over where the new slaves would come from to ensure there was no pause in labor, and about how they should treat their own slaves afterward. Despite the chiming bells and the raising and dimming of the chandeliers, it took the boxes far longer to quiet than usual. They were still talking when the red curtains pulled back to reveal the seated orchestra, and it was a miracle they bothered to applaud for the conductor as he hobbled across the stage. That was when they noticed that every musician on the stage was wearing mourning black. That was when they shut up, and when the conductor raised his arms. It was not a symphony that filled the cavernous space. It was the song of Eilwë, then the song of Fenharrow, and Melisande, and Taryssen. Each nation that had people in those labor camps. And finally, not for pomp or triumph, but to mourn what they had become, they played the song of Otterlin. When the final note finished, the conductor turned to the crowd, the musicians standing with him. As one, they looked to the boxes, to all those jewels bought with the blood of a continent. And without a word, without a bow or another gesture, they walked off the stage. The next morning, by royal decree, the theater was shut down. No one saw those musicians or their conductor again. Chapter 50. A cooling breeze kissed down Selena's neck. The forest had gone silent, as if the birds and insects had been quieted by her assault on the invisible wall. The barrier had gobbled down every spark of magic she'd launched at it, and now seemed to hum with fresh power. The scent of pine and snow wrapped around her, and she turned to find Rowan standing against a nearby tree. He'd been there for some time now, giving her space to work herself into exhaustion. But she was not tired, and she was not done. There was still wildfire in her mind, writhing, endless, damning. She let it dim to embers, let the grief and horror die down too. Rowan said,
"Word just arrived from Wendlin. Reinforcements aren't coming."
"They didn't come 10 years ago," she said, her throat raw, though she had not spoken in hours. Cold, glittering calm was now flowing in her veins. Why should they bother helping now? His eyes flickered.
"Aelin,
When she only gazed into the darkening forest, he suddenly said,
"You do not have to stay. We can go to Dorinel tonight, and you can retrieve your knowledge from Maeve. You have my blessing."
"Do not insult me by asking me to leave. I am fighting.
Nehemia would have stayed.
My parents would have stayed.
They also had the luxury of knowing that their bloodline did not end with them."
She gritted her teeth.
"You have experience. You are needed here. You are the only person who can give the Demi-Fae a chance of surviving. You are trusted and respected. So I am staying. Because you are needed, and because I will follow you to whatever end."
And if the creatures devoured her body and soul, then she would not mind. She had earned that fate.
For a long moment, he said nothing,
but his brows narrowed slightly.
"To whatever end."
She nodded.
He had not needed to mention the massacres, had not needed to try to console her. He knew.
He understood without her having to say a word what it was like. Her magic thrummed in her blood, wanting out, wanting more. But it would wait. It had to wait until it was time, until she had Narok and his creatures in her sight.
She realized that Rowan saw each of those thoughts and more as he reached into his tunic and pulled out a dagger. Her dagger. He extended it to her, its long blade gleaming as if he'd been secretly polishing and caring for it these months. When she grasped the dagger, its weight lighter than she remembered, Rowan looked into her eyes, into the very core of her, and said,
"Fireheart."
Reinforcements from Wendlin weren't coming, not out of spite, but because a legion of Otterlin's men had attacked the northern border. 3,000 men in ships had launched a full-on assault. Wendlin had sent every last soldier to the northern coast, and there they would remain. The Demi-Fae were to face Narok and his forces alone. Rowan calmingly encouraged the non-fighters at the fortress to flee. But no one fled. Even Emrys refused, and Malachi merely said that where his mate went, he went. For hours, they adjusted their plans to accommodate the lack of reinforcements. In the end, they didn't have to change much, thankfully. Selena contributed what she could to the planning, letting Rowan order everyone about and adjust the masterful strategy in that brilliant head of his. She tried not to think about Endovir and Calicalla, but the knowledge of it still simmered in her, brewing during the long hours that they debated. They planned until Emrys hauled up a pot from the kitchen and began whacking it with a spoon, ordering them out because dawn would come too soon. Within a minute of returning to their room, Selena was undressing and flopping into bed. Rowan took his time, however, peeling off his shirt and striding to the wash basin.
"You did well helping me plan tonight."
She watched him wash his face, then his neck.
"You sound surprised."
He wiped his face with a towel, then leaned against the dresser, bracing his hands against either end. The wood groaned, but his face remained still. Fireheart, he had called her. Did he know what that name meant to her? She wanted to ask, still had so many questions for him. But right now, after all the news of the day, she needed to sleep.
"I sent word,"
Rowan said, letting go of the dresser and approaching the bed. She'd left the sword from the mountain cave on the bedpost, and its smoldering ruby now glinted in the dim light as he ran a finger down the golden hilt.
"To my cadre, as you like to call them."
She braced herself on her elbows. "When?"
"A few days ago. I don't know where they all are or whether they'll arrive in time. Maeve might not let them come, or some of them might not even ask her. They can be unpredictable. And it may be that I just get the order to return to Doranelle and—
You actually called for aid?
His eyes narrowed.
I just said that I did.
She stood, and he retreated a step. What changed your mind?
Some things are worth the risk.
He didn't back away again as she approached and said with every ember left in her shredded heart, I claim you, Rowan Whitethorn. I don't care what you say and how much you protest. I claim you as my friend.
He just turned to the wash basin again.
But she caught the unspoken words that he'd tried to keep her from reading on his face.
It doesn't matter. Even if we survive, when we go to Doranelle, you will walk out of Maeve's realm alone.
Emrys joined them, along with all the demi-fae at Mistward who had not been dispatched with messages, in traveling down to the healer's compound the next morning to help cart the patients to safety. Anyone who could not fight remained to help the sick and wounded, and Emrys declared he would stay there until the very end. So they left him, along with a small contingent of sentries in case things went very, very wrong. When Celaena headed off into the trees with Rowan, she did not bother with goodbyes. Many of the others did not say farewell either. It seemed like an invitation for death, and Celaena was fairly certain she wasn't on the good side of the gods. She was awoken that night by a large, calloused hand on her shoulder, shaking her awake. It seemed that death was already waiting for them. Chapter 51.
Get your sword and your weapons and hurry,
Rowan said to Celaena, as she instantly came to her feet, reaching for the dagger beside the bed. He was already halfway across the room, slinging on his clothes and weapons with lethal efficiency. She didn't bother with questions. He would tell her what was necessary. She hopped into her pants and boots.
I think we've been betrayed, Rowan said,
and her fingers caught on a buckle of her sword belt as she turned to the open window. Quiet. Absolute quiet in the forest. And along the horizon, a growing smear of blackness.
They're coming tonight, she breathed.
I did a sweep of the perimeter.
Rowan stuffed a knife into his boot.
It's as if someone told them where every trap, every warning bell is located. They'll be here within the hour.
Are the wardstones still working?
She finished braiding her hair and strapped her sword across her back.
Yes, they're intact. I raised the alarm, and Malachi and the others are readying our defenses on the walls.
A small part of her smiled at the thought of what it must have been like for Malachi to find a half-naked Rowan shouting orders in his room. She asked,
Who would have betrayed us?
I don't know. And when I find them, I'll splatter them on the walls. But for now, we have bigger problems to worry about.
The darkness on the horizon had spread, devouring the stars, the trees, the light.
What is that?
Rowan's mouth tightened into a thin line.
Bigger problems.
The wardstones were the last line of defense before the fortress itself. If Narok planned to lay siege to Mistward, they couldn't outlast him forever. But hopefully the barrier would wear down the creatures and their power a bit. On the battlements, in the courtyard and atop the towers, stood the demi-fae. Archers would take down as many men as possible once the barrier fell, and they would use the oak doors of the fortress as a bottleneck into the courtyard. But there were still the creatures and Narok, along with the darkness that they carried with them. Birds and animals streamed past the fortress as they fled. An exodus of flapping wings, padding feet, claws clicking on stone. Herding the animals to safety were the little folk, hardly more than a gleam of night-seeing eyes. Whatever darkness Narok and the creatures brought, once you went in, you did not come out. She was standing with Rowan just beyond the gates of the courtyard, the grassy expanse of earth between the fortress and the wardstones feeling far too small. The animals and little folk had stopped appearing moments before, and even the wind had died.
As soon as the barrier falls, I want you to put arrows through their eyes, Rowan said to her, his bow slack in his hands. Don't give them a chance to enthrall you or anyone. Leave the soldiers to the others.
They hadn't heard or seen any of the 200 men, but she nodded, gripping her own bow. What about magic?
Use it sparingly. But if you think you can destroy them with it, don't hesitate. And don't get fancy. Take them down by any means possible.
Such icy calculation. Purebred, undiluted warrior. She could almost feel the aggression pouring off him. A reek was rising from beyond the barrier, and some of the sentries in the courtyard behind them began murmuring. A smell from another world, from whatever hellish creature lurked under mortal skin. Some straggling animals darted out of the trees, foaming at the mouth, the darkness behind them thickening. Rowan? She said, as she felt rather than saw them. They're here. At the edge of the trees, hardly 5 yards from the wardstones, the creatures emerged. Selena started. Three, not two. But the skinwalkers... She couldn't finish the words as the three men surveyed the fortress. They were clad in deepest black, their tunics open to reveal the wordstone torques at their throats. The skinwalkers hadn't killed it. No, because there was that same perfect male looking straight at her, smiling at her, as if he could already taste her. A rabbit bolted out of the bushes, racing for the wardstones. Like the paw of a massive beast, the darkness behind the creatures lashed out, sweeping over the fleeing animal. The rabbit fell mid-leap, its fur turning dull and matted, bones pushing through as the life was sucked out of it. The sentries on the walls and towers stirred, some swearing. She had stood a chance of escaping the clutches of just one of those creatures. But all three together became something else, something infinitely powerful.
The barrier cannot be allowed to fall, Rowan said to her. That blackness will kill anything it touches.
Even as he spoke, the darkness stretched around the fortress, trapping them. The barrier hummed, and the reverberations zinged against the soles of her boots. She shifted into her fey form, wincing against the pain. She needed the sharper hearing, the strength and healing. Still, the three creatures remained on the forest edge, the darkness spreading. No sign of the 200 soldiers. As one, the three half turned to the shadows behind them and stepped aside, heads bowed. Then, stalking out of the trees, Narok appeared. Unlike the others, Narok was not beautiful. He was scarred and powerfully built, and armed to the teeth. But he, too, had skin carved with those glittering black veins, and wore that torque of obsidian. Even from this distance, she could see the devouring emptiness in his eyes. It seeped toward them like blood in a river. She waited for him to say something, to parley and offer a choice between yielding to the king's power or death, to give some speech to break their morale. but Narok looked upon Mistward with a slow, almost delighted sweep of the head, drew his iron blade, and pointed at the curving wardstone gates. There was nothing Celaena or Rowan could do, as a whip of darkness snapped out and struck the invisible barrier. The air shuddered, and the stones whined. Rowan was already moving toward the oak doors, shouting orders to the archers to ready themselves, and use whatever magic they had to shield against the oncoming darkness. Celaena remained where she was. Another strike, and the barrier rippled.
Aelin,
Rowan snapped, and she looked over her shoulder at him.
Get inside the gates.
But she slung her bow across her back, and when she raised her hand, it was consumed with fire. In the woods that night, it balked from the flame.
To use it, you'll have to get outside the barrier, or it'll just rebound against the walls.
I know, she said quietly.
The last time, you took one look at that thing and fell under its spell.
The darkness lashed again. It won't be like last time, she said, eyes on Narok, on his three creatures. Not when she had a score to settle. Her blood heated, but she said, I don't know what else to do. Because if that darkness reached them, then all the blades and arrows would be useless. They wouldn't have a chance to strike. A cry sounded behind them, followed by a few more, then the clash of metal on metal. Someone shouted, The tunnel! They've been let in through the tunnel! For a moment, Celaena just stood there, blinking. The escape tunnel. They had been betrayed. And now they knew where the soldiers were, creeping through the underground network, let in perhaps because the wardstones, with that strange sentience, were too focused on the threat above to be able to contain the one below. The shouting and fighting grew louder. Rowan had stationed their weaker fighters inside to keep them safe, right in the path of the tunnel entrance. It would be a slaughterhouse. Rowan! Another blow to the barrier from the darkness, and another. She began walking toward the stones, and Rowan growled,
Do not take one more step.
She kept going. Inside the fortress, screaming had begun, pain and death and terror. Each step away from it tore at her, but she headed to the stones, toward the megalith gates. Rowan grabbed her elbow.
That was an order.
She knocked his hand away. You're needed inside. Leave the barrier to me.
You don't know if it'll work.
It will work, she snarled. I'm the expendable one, Rowan.
You are heir to the throne of...
Right now, I am a woman who has a power that might save lives. Let me do this. Help the others. Rowan looked at the wardstones, at the fortress and the sentries scrambling to help below, weighing, calculating. At last, Rowan said,
Do not engage them. You focus on that darkness and keeping it away from the barrier, and that's it. Hold the line, Aelin.
But she didn't want to hold the line, not when her enemy was so close. Not when the weight of those souls at Calicula and Endovir pressed on her, screaming as loudly as the soldiers inside the fortress. She had failed all of them. She had been too late. And it was enough. But she nodded, like the good soldier Rowan believed she was, and said, Understood.
They will attack you the moment you set foot outside the barrier,
he said. Releasing her arm. Her magic began to boil in her veins.
Have a shield ready.
I know, was her only answer, as she neared the barrier and the swirling dark beyond. The curving stones of the gateway loomed, and she drew the sword from her back with her right hand,
her left hand enveloped in flame.
Nehemia's people, butchered.
Her own people, butchered. Her people. Selena stepped under the archway of stones, magic zinging and kissing her skin. Just a few steps would take her outside the barrier. She could feel Rowan lingering, waiting to see if she would survive the first few moments. But she would. She was going to burn these things into ash and dust. This was the least she owed those murdered in Andovia and Calicalla. The least she could do, after so long. A monster to destroy monsters. The flames on her left hand burned brighter, as Selena stepped beyond the archway and into the beckoning abyss. Chapter 52. The darkness lashed at Selena the moment she passed beyond the invisible barrier. A wall of flame seared across the sphere of blackness, and, just as she'd gambled, the blackness recoiled, only to strike again, swift as an asp. She met it blow for blow, willing the fire to spread, a wall of red and gold encasing the barrier behind her. She ignored the reek of the creatures, the hollowness of the air at her ears, the overwhelming throbbing in her head. So much worse beyond the protection of the wards, especially now that all three creatures were gathered. But she did not give them one inch, even as blood began trickling from her nose. The darkness lunged for her, simultaneously assaulting the wall, punching holes through her flame. She patched them by reflex, allowing the power to do as it willed, but with the command to protect, to keep that barrier shielded. She took another step beyond the stone gateway. Narok was nowhere to be seen, but the three creatures were waiting for her. Unlike the other night in the woods, they were armed with long, slender swords that they drew with their unearthly grace. And then they attacked. Good. She did not look them in the eyes, nor did she acknowledge the bleeding from her nose and the pressure in her ears. She merely called in a shield of fire around her left forearm, and began swinging that ancient sword. Whether Rowan lingered to see her break his first order, then his next, she didn't know. The three creatures kept coming at her, swift and controlled, as if they'd had eons to practice swordplay, as if they were all of one mind, one body. Where she deflected one, another was there. Where she punched one with flame and steel, another was ducking beneath it to grab her. She could not let them touch her, could not let herself meet their gaze. The shield around the barrier burned hot at her back, the darkness of the creature stinging and biting at it, but she held firm. She had not lied to Rowan about that, about protecting the wall. One of them swept its blade at her, not to kill, to incapacitate. It was second nature somehow that flames leapt down her blade as she struck back, willing fire into the sword itself. When it met the black iron of the creature, blue sparks danced, so bright that she dared to look into the creature's face to glimpse surprise, horror, rage. The hilt of the sword was warming, comforting in her hand, and the red stone glowed as if with a fire of its own. The three creatures stopped in unison, their sensual mouths pulling back from their two white teeth in a snarl. The one in the center, the one who had tasted her before, hissed at the sword. Goldrin. The darkness paused, and she used its distraction to patch her shields, a chill snaking up her spine even as the flames warmed her. She lifted the sword higher and advanced another step.
But you are not Aethryl, beloved of the Dark Queen,
one of them said. Another said,
and you are not Brennan of the Wildfire.
How do you— But the words caught in her throat as a memory struck, from months ago, a lifetime ago, of a realm that was in between, of the thing that lived inside Cain speaking. To her and Elena. Elena, daughter of Brannon. You were brought back, it said. All the players in the unfinished game. A game that had begun at the dawn of time, when a demon race had forged the word keys and used them to break into this world, and Maeve had used their power to banish them. But some demons had remained trapped in Aurelia and waged a second war centuries later, when Elena fought against them. What of the others, who had been sent back to their realm? What if the King of Otterlin, in learning of the keys, had also learned where to find them? Where to harness them? Oh, gods. You are the Volg, she breathed. The three things inside those mortal bodies smiled. We are princes of our realm. And what realm is that? She poured her magic into the shield behind her. The Volg prince in the center seemed to reach toward her without moving an inch. She sent a punch of flame at him, and he curled back. A realm of eternal dark and ice and wind, he said. And we have been waiting a very, very long time to taste your sunshine again. The King of Otterlin was either more powerful than she could imagine, or the most foolish man to ever live, if he thought he could control these demon princes. Blood dripped onto her tunic from her nose. Their leader purred, Once you let me in, girl, there shall be no more blood or pain. She sent another wall of flame searing at them. Brannon and the others beat you into oblivion once, she said, though her lungs were burning. We can do it again. Low laughter. We were not beaten, only contained, until a mortal man was foolish enough to invite us back in, to use these glorious bodies. Were the men who had once occupied them still inside? If she cut off their heads, that torque of wordstone, would the creatures vanish or be unleashed in another form? This was far, far worse than she had expected. Yes, the leader said, taking a step toward her and sniffing. You should fear us and embrace us. Embrace this, she snarled, and flung a hidden dagger from her vambrace at his head. He was so swift that it scraped his cheek rather than wedging itself between its eyes. Black blood welled and flowed. He raised a moon-white hand to examine it. I shall enjoy devouring you from the inside out, he said. And the darkness lunged for her again. The battle was still raging inside the fortress, which was good, because it meant they hadn't all died yet. And Selena was still swinging Goldrin against the three Volg princes, though it grew heavier by the moment, and the shield behind her was beginning to fray. She had not had time to tunnel down into her power, or to consider rationing it. The darkness that the Volg brought with them continued to strike the wall, so Selena threw up shield after shield, fire flaming through her blood, her breath, her mind. She gave her magic free rein, only asking it to keep the shield behind her alive. It did so, gobbling up her reserves. Rowan had not come back to help. But she told herself he would come, and he would help, because it was not weakness to admit she needed him, needed his help, and her lower back cramped, and it was all she could do to keep her grip on the legendary blade as the leader of the Volg princes swiped for her neck. No. A muscle twinged near her spine, twisting until she had to bite down a scream as she deflected the blow. It couldn't be a burnout. Not so soon.
Not after practicing so much. Not... A hole tore through the shield behind her, and the darkness slammed into the barrier, making the magic ripple and shriek. She flung a thought toward it, and as the flame patched it up, her blood began to pound. The princes were closing in again. She growled, sending a wall of white-hot flame at them, pushing them back, 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 while she took a deep breath. But blood came coughing out, instead of air. If she ran inside the gates, how long would the shield last before it fell to the princes in their ancient darkness? How long would any of those inside last? She didn't dare look behind to see who was winning. It didn't sound good. There were no cries of victory, only pain and fear. Her knees quaked, but she swallowed the blood in her mouth and took another breath. She had not imagined it would end like this, and maybe it was what she deserved after turning her back on her kingdom. One of the Volg princes ripped a hand through the wall of flame separating them, the darkness shielding his flesh from being melted off. She was about to send another blast at him, when a movement from the trees caught her eye. Far up the hill, as if they had come racing down from the mountains and had not stopped for food or water or slept, were a towering man, a massive bird, and three of the largest predators she had ever seen. Five in all. Answering their friend's desperate call for aid. They hurtled through the trees and over stones. Two wolves, one black and one moon white, the powerfully built male, the birds swooping low over them, and a familiar mountain cat racing behind, heading for the darkness looming between them and the fortress. The black wolf skidded to a halt as they neared the darkness, as if sensing what it could do. The screaming in the fortress rose. If the newcomers could destroy the soldiers, the survivors could take the tunnel and flee before the dark consumed everything. Sweat stung Selena's eyes, and pain sliced into her so deep that she wondered if it was permanent. But she had not lied to Rowan about saving lives. So she did not stop to doubt or consider, as she flung the remnants of her power toward Rowan's five friends, a bridge of flame through the darkness, cleaving it in two, a path toward the gates behind her. To their credit, Rowan's friends did not hesitate as they raced for it, the wolves leading the way, the bird, an osprey, close behind. She poured her power into the bridge, gritting her teeth against the agony as the five rushed past, not sparing her a glance. But the golden mountain cat slowed as he charged through the gates behind her, as her chest seized and she coughed, her blood bright on the grass.
"He's inside," she choked out. "Help him."
The great cat lingered, assessing her and the wall and the princes fighting against her flame.
"Go,"
she wheezed. The bridge through the darkness collapsed, and she staggered back a step as that black power slammed into her, the shield, the world. The blood was roaring so loudly in her ears that she could barely hear when the mountain cat raced for the fortress. Rowan's friends had come. Good. Good that he would not be alone, that he had people in the world. She coughed blood again, splattering it on the ground, on the legs of the Volg prince. She barely moved before he slammed her into her own flames, and she hit the magical wall beneath, as hard and unforgiving as if it were made of stone. The only way into the fortress was through the ward gates. She swiped with Goldrin, but the blow was feeble. Against the Volg, against this horrible power that the King of Otterlin possessed, the army at his disposal. It was all useless. As useless as the vow she'd made to Nehemia's grave. As useless as an heir to a broken throne and a broken name. The magic was boiling her blood. The darkness. It would be a relief compared to the hell smoldering in her veins. The Vogue Prince advanced, and part of her was screaming. Screaming at herself to get up, to keep fighting, to rage and roar against this horrible end. But moving her limbs, even breathing, had become a monumental effort. She was so tired. The fortress was a hell of yelling and fighting and gore, but Rowan kept swinging his blades, holding his position at the tunnel mouth as soldier after soldier poured in. The scout leader, Bass, had let them in, Luca had told Rowan. The other demi-fey who had conspired with Bass wanted the power the creatures offered, wanted a place in the world. From the devastation in the bleeding boy's eyes, Rowan knew that Bass had already met his end. He hoped Luca hadn't been the one to do it. The soldiers kept coming, highly trained men who were not afraid of the demi-fey or of the little magic that they bore. They were armed with iron and did not differentiate between young and old, male and female, as they hacked and slaughtered. Rowan was not drained, not in the least. He had fought for longer and in worse conditions. But the others were flagging, especially as soldiers continued flooding the fortress. Rowan yanked his sword from the gut of a falling soldier, dagger already slicing across the neck of the next, when growling shook the stones of the fortress. Some of the demi-fey froze, but Rowan nearly shuddered with relief as twin wolves leapt down the staircase and closed their jaws around the necks of two Otterlanian soldiers. Great wings flapped, and then a glowering, dark-eyed male was in front of him, swinging a sword older than the occupants of Mistward. Vaughn merely nodded at him before taking up a position, never one to waste words. Beyond him, the wolves were nothing short of lethal, and did not bother to shift into their fey forms as they took down soldier after soldier, leaving those that got through to the male waiting behind them. That was all Rowan had to see before he sprinted for the stairs, dodging the stunned and bloodied demi-fey. Darkness had not fallen, which meant she still had to be breathing, she still had to be holding the line, but a mountain cat skidded to a halt on the stairwell landing and shifted. Rowan took one look at Gavrielle's tawny eyes and said,
"Where is she?"
Gavrielle held out an arm, as if to stop him.
"She's in bad shape, Rowan. I think..."
Rowan ran, shoving aside his oldest friend, shouldering past the other towering male who now appeared. Lorcan. Even Lorcan had answered his call. The time for gratitude would come later, and the dark-haired demi-fey didn't say anything as Rowan rushed to the battlement gates. What he saw beyond almost drove him to his knees. The wall of flame was in tatters, but still protecting the barrier. But the three creatures. Aelin was standing in front of them, hunched and panting, sword limp in her hand. They advanced, and a feeble blue flame sprang up before them. They swiped it away with a wave of their hands. Another flame sprang up, and her knees buckled. The shield of flame surged and receded, pulsing like the light around her body. She was burning out. Why hadn't she retreated? Another step closer, and the thing said something that had her raising her head. Rowan knew he could not reach her, didn't even have the breath to shout a warning as Aelin gazed into the face of the creature before her. She had lied to him. She had wanted to save lives, yes, but she had gone out there with no intention of saving her own. He drew in a breath, to run, to roar, to summon his power. But a wall of muscle slammed into him from behind, tackling him to the grass. Though Rowan shoved and twisted against Gavrielle, he could do nothing against the 4 centuries of training and feline instinct that had pinned him, keeping him from running through those gates and into the blackness that destroyed worlds. The creature took Aelin's face in its hands, and her sword thudded to the ground. Forgotten. Rowan was screaming as the creature pulled her into its arms. As she stopped fighting. As her flames winked out. And darkness swallowed her whole. Chapter 53.
There was blood everywhere. As before, Selena stood between the two bloody beds, reeking breath caressing her ear, her neck, her spine. She could feel the Volg princes roving around her, circling with predators' gates, devouring her misery and pain bit by bit, tasting and savoring. There was no way out, and she could not move as she looked from one bed to the other. Nehemia's corpse, mangled and mutilated. Because she had been too late, and because she had been a coward. And her parents, throats slit from ear to ear, gray and lifeless, dead from an attack they should have sensed, an attack she should have sensed. Maybe she had sensed it, and that was why she had crept in that night. But she had been too late then as well. Two beds, two fractures in her soul, cracks through which the abyss had come pouring in long before the Volg princes ever seized her. A claw scraped along her neck, and she jerked away, stumbling toward her parents' corpses. The moment that darkness had swept around her, snuffing out her exhausted flame, it began eating away at the reckless rage that had compelled her to step out of the barrier. Here, in the dark, the silence was complete. Eternal. She could feel the Volg slinking around her, hungry and eager and full of cold, ancient malice. She'd expected to have the life sucked from her instantly. But they had just stayed close in the dark, brushing up against her like cats, until a faint light had formed and she'd found herself between these two beds. She was unable to look away, unable to do anything but feel her nausea and panic rise bit by bit. And now. Now. Though her body remained unmoving on the bed, Nehemia's voice whispered, "Coward." Selena vomited. A faint, hoarse laugh sounded behind her. She backed up, farther and farther from the bed where Nehemia lay. Then she was standing in a sea of red, red and white and gray, and she now stood like a wraith in her parents' bed, where she had lain 10 years ago, awakening between their corpses to the servant woman's screaming. It was those screams she could hear now, high and endless and coward. Selena fell against the headboard, as real and smooth and cold as she remembered it. There was nowhere else for her to go. It was a memory. These were not real things. She pressed her palms against the wood, fighting her building scream. Coward. Nehemia's voice again filled the room. Selena squeezed her eyes shut and said into the wall, "I know. I know." She did not fight, as cold, claw-tipped fingers stroked at her cheeks, at her brow, at her shoulders. One of the claws severed clean through her long braid as it whipped her around. She did not fight, as darkness swallowed her whole and dragged her down deep. The darkness had no end and no beginning. It was the abyss that had haunted her steps for 10 years, and she free fell into it, welcomed it. There was no sound, only the vague sense of going toward a bottom that might not exist, or that might mean her true end. Maybe the Volg princes had devoured her, turning her into a husk. Maybe her soul was forever trapped here, in this plunging darkness. Perhaps this was hell. The blackness was rippling now, shifting with sound and color that she passed through.
She lived through each image, each memory worse than the next. Kaol's face as he saw what she truly was, Nehemia's mutilated body, her final conversation with her friend, the damning things she'd said.
When your people are lying dead around you, don't come crying to me.
It had come true. Now thousands of slaves from Eelway had been slaughtered for their bravery. She tumbled through a maelstrom of the moments when she had proved her friend right. She was a waste of space and breath, a stain on the world, unworthy of her birthright. This was hell, and looked like hell, as she saw the bloodbath she'd created on the day she rampaged through Endovir, the screams of the dying, the men she'd cut apart, tore at her like phantom hands. This was what she deserved. She went mad during that first day in Endovir. Went mad as the descent slowed, and she was stripped and strapped between two blood-splattered posts. The cold air nipped at her bare breasts, a bite that was nothing compared to the terror and agony as a whip cracked, and she jerked against the ropes binding her. She scarcely had time to draw in a breath before the crack sounded again, cleaving the world like lightning, cleaving her skin.
Coward, Nehemia said behind her, and the whip cracked. Coward.
The pain was blinding. Look at me. She couldn't lift her head, though, couldn't turn.
Look at me.
She sagged against her ropes, but managed to look over her shoulder. Nehemia was whole, beautiful and untouched, her eyes full of damning hatred. And then from behind her emerged Sam, handsome and tall. His death had been so similar to Nehemia's, and yet so much worse, drawn out over hours. She had not saved him either. When she beheld the iron-tipped whip in his hands, when he stepped past Nehemia and let the whip unfurl onto the rocky earth, Selena let out a low, quiet laugh. She welcomed the pain with open arms as he took a deep breath, clothes shifting with the movement as he snapped the whip. The iron tip. Oh, gods, it ripped her clean open, knocked her legs out from underneath her.
Again,
Selena told him, the word little more than a rasp.
Again.
Sam obeyed. There was only the thud of leather on wet flesh as Sam and Nehemia took turns, and a line of people formed behind them, waiting for what they deserved as payment for what she had failed to do. Such a long line of people. So many lives that she had taken or failed to protect. Again. 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 She had not walked past the barrier expecting to defeat the Vog princes. She had walked out there for the same reason she had snapped that day in Endovir. But the Vog princes had not killed her yet. She had felt their pleasure as she begged for the whipping. It was their sustenance. Her mortal flesh was nothing to them. It was the agony within that was the prize. They would draw this out forever, keep her as their pet. There was no one to save her, no one who could enter their darkness and live. One by one, they groped through her memories. She fed them, gave them everything they wanted and more. Back and back, sorting through the years as they plunged into the dark, twining together. She did not care. She had not looked into the Vog's prince's eyes expecting to ever again see sunrise. She did not know how long she fell with them. But then there was a rushing, roaring below. A frozen river. Whispers and foggy light were rising to meet them. No, not rising. This was the bottom. An end to the abyss, and an end to her, perhaps, at last. She didn't know if the Vog Prince's hissing was from anger or pleasure, as they slammed into that frozen river at the bottom of her soul. Chapter 54. Trumpets announced his arrival. Trumpets and silence as the people of Orinth crowded the steep streets winding up to the White Palace that watched over them all. It was the first sunny day in weeks, the snow on the cobblestone streets melting quickly, though the wind still had a final bite of winter to it, enough so that the King of Otterlin and his entire massive party were bundled in furs that covered their regalia. Their gold and crimson flags, however, flapped in the crisp wind, the golden poles shining as brightly as the armor of their bearers, who trotted at the head of the party. She watched them approach from one of the balconies off the throne room, Adian at her side running a constant commentary about the state of their horses, armor, weapons, about the King of Otterlin himself, who rode near the front on a great black war horse. There was a pony beside him, bearing a smaller figure. "His sniveling son," Adian told her. The whole castle was miserably quiet. Everyone was dashing around, but silently, tensely. Her father had been on edge at breakfast, her mother distracted, the whole court snarly and wearing far more weapons than usual. Only her uncle seemed the same. Only Orlan had smiled at her today, said she looked very pretty in her blue dress and golden crown, and tugged one of her freshly pressed curls. No one had told her anything about this visit, but she knew it was important, because even Adian was wearing clean clothes, a crown, and a new dagger, which he'd taken to tossing in the air.
"Adian! Aelin!"
someone hissed from inside the throne room. Lady Marion, her mother's dearest friend and handmaiden.
"On the dais, now!"
Behind the lovely lady peeked a night-black head of hair and onyx eyes. Elide, her daughter. The girl was too quiet and breakable for her to bother with usually, and Lady Marion, her nursemaid, coddled her own daughter endlessly.
"Rat's balls!"
Adian cursed, and Marion went red with anger, but did not reprimand. Proof enough that today was different. Dangerous, even. Her stomach shifted, but she followed Lady Marion inside, Adian at her heels as always, and perched on her little throne set beside her father's. Adian took up his place flanking her, shoulders back and head high, already her protector and warrior. The whole of Orinth was silent as the King of Otterlin entered their mountain home. She hated the King of Otterlin. He did not smile, not when he stalked into the throne room to greet her uncle and parents, not when he introduced his eldest son, Crown Prince Dorian Havilliard, and not when they came to the Great Hall for the largest feast she'd ever seen. He'd only looked at her twice so far, once during that initial meeting, when he'd stared at her long and hard enough that her father had demanded to know what he found so interesting about his daughter, and their whole court had tensed. But she hadn't broken his dark stare. She hated his scarred, brutish face and furs, hated the way he ignored his dark-haired son, who stood like a pretty doll beside him, his manner so elegant and graceful, his pale hands like little birds as they moved. The second time the king had looked at her had been at this table, where she now sat a few seats down, flanked by Lady Marion on the side closest to the king and Adian on the other. There were daggers on Lady Marion's legs beneath her dress. She knew because she kept bumping into them. Lord Cal, Marion's husband, sat beside his wife, the steel on him gleaming. Elide, along with all the other children, had been sent upstairs. Only she and Adian, and Prince Dorian, were allowed here. Adian puffed with pride and barely restrained his temper when the King of Otterlin viewed her a second time, as if he could see through to her bones. Then the king was swept into conversation with her parents and uncle, and all the lords and ladies of the court who had placed themselves around the royal family. She had always known her court took no chances, not with her and not with her parents or uncle. Even now, she noticed the eyes of her father's closest friends darting to the windows and doorways as they maintained conversation with those around them. The rest of the hall was filled with the party from Otterlin and the outer circles of Orland's court, along with key merchants from the city who wanted to make ties with Otterlin, or something like that. But her attention was on the prince across from her, who seemed utterly ignored by his father and his own court. Shoved down near the end with her and Adian. He ate so beautifully, she thought, watching him cut into his roast chicken. Not a drop moved out of place. Not a scrap fell on the table. She had decent manners, while Adian was hopeless, his plate littered with bones and crumbs scattered everywhere, even some on her own dress. She'd kicked him for it, but his attention was too focused on the royals down the table. So both she and the crown prince were to be ignored then. She looked at the boy again, who was around her age, she supposed. His skin was from the winter, his blue-black hair neatly trimmed, his sapphire eyes lifted from his plate to meet hers. "You eat like a fine lady," she told him. His lips thinned, and color stained his ivory cheeks. Across from her, Quinn, her uncle's captain of the guard, choked on his water. The prince glanced at his father, still busy with her uncle, before replying. Not for approval, but in fear. "I eat like a prince," Dorian said quietly.
"You do not need to cut your bread with a fork and knife," she said.
A faint pounding started in her head, followed by a flickering warmth. But she ignored it. The hall was hot, as they'd shut all the windows for some reason.
"Here in the north," she went on, as the prince's knife and fork remained where they were on his dinner roll, "you need not be so formal. We don't put on airs."
Hen, one of Quinn's men, coughed pointedly from a few seats down. She could almost hear him saying, "Says the little lady with her hair pressed into careful curls, and wearing her new dress that she threatened to skin us over if we got dirty."
She gave Hen an equally pointed look, then returned her attention to the foreign prince. He'd already looked down at his food again, as if he expected to be neglected for the rest of the night. And he looked lonely enough that she said, "If you like, you could be my friend."
None of the men around him said anything, or coughed.
Dorian lifted his chin. "I have a friend. He is to be Lord of Aniel someday, and the fiercest warrior in the land."
She doubted Adian would like that claim, but her cousin remained focused down the table. She wished she'd kept her mouth closed. Even this useless foreign prince had friends. The pounding in her head increased, and she took a drink of her water. Water. Always water to cool her insides. Reaching for her glass, however, sent spikes of red-hot pain through her head, and she winced.
"Princess?"
Quinn said, always the first to notice. She blinked, black spots forming. But the pain stopped. No. Not a stop, but a pause. A pause, then, right between her eyes, it ached and pressed at her head, trying to get in. She rubbed her brows. Her throat closed up, and she reached for the water, thinking of coolness, of calm and cold, exactly as her tutors in the court had told her. But the magic was churning in her gut, burning up. Each pulse of pain in her head made it worse.
"Princess?"
Quinn said again. She got to her feet, legs wobbling. The blackness in her vision grew with each blow from the pain, and she swayed.
distantly, as if she were underwater. She heard Lady Marian say her name, reach for her, but she wanted her mother's cool touch. Her mother turned in her seat, face drawn, her golden earrings catching in the light. She stretched out an arm, beckoning.
What is it, Fireheart? I don't feel well, she said,
barely able to get the words out. She gripped her mother's velvet-clad arm, for comfort and to keep her buckling knees from giving out.
What feels wrong?
Her mother asked, even as she put a hand to her forehead. A flicker of worry, then a glance back at her father, who watched from beside the King of Otterlin.
She's burning up, she said softly.
Lady Marian was suddenly behind her, and her mother looked up to say,
Have the healer go to her room.
Marian was gone in an instant, hurrying to a side door. She didn't need a healer, and she gripped her mother's arm to tell her as much. Yet no words would come out as the magic surged and burned. Her mother hissed and jerked back, smoke rising from her dress, from where she had gripped her.
Aelin?
Her head gave a throb, a blast of pain, and then a wriggling, squirming inside her head. A worm of darkness pushing its way in. Her magic roiled, thrashing, trying to get it out, to burn it up, to save them both, but...
Aelin? Get it out,
she rasped, pushing at her temples as she backed away from the table. Two of the foreign lords grabbed Dorian from the table and swept him from the room. Her magic bucked like a stallion as the worm wriggled farther in.
Get it out!
Aelin?
Her father was on his feet now, hand on his sword. Half the others were standing too, but she flung out a hand to keep them away, to warn them. Blue flame shot out. Two people dove in time to avoid it, but everyone was on their feet as the vacated seats went up in flames. The worm would latch into her mind and never let go. She grabbed at her head, her magic screaming, so loud it could shatter the world. And then she was burning, a living column of turquoise flame, sobbing as the dark worm continued its work and the walls of her mind began to give. Above her own voice, above the shouting in the hall, she heard her father's bellow, a command to her mother, who was on her knees, hands outstretched toward her in supplication.
Do it, Evelyn!
The pillar of flame grew hotter, hot enough that people were fleeing now. Her mother's eyes met her own, full of pleading and pain. Then water. A wall of water crashing down on her, slamming her to the stones, flowing down her throat, into her eyes, choking her, drowning her, until there was no air for her flame, only water and its freezing embrace. The King of Otterlin looked at her for a third time and smiled. The Volg princes enjoyed that memory, that terror and pain. As they paused to savor it, Celaena understood. The King of Otterlin had used his power on her that night. Her parents could not have known that the person responsible for that dark worm, which had vanished as soon as she'd lost consciousness, was the man sitting beside them. There was another of them now, a fourth prince, living inside Narok, who said,
The soldiers have almost taken the tunnel. Be ready to move soon.
She could feel him hovering over her, observing.
You found me a prize that will interest our liege. Do not waste her. Sips only.
She tried to summon horror, tried to feel anything at the thought of where they would take her, what they would do to her. But she could feel nothing as the princes murmured their understanding, and the memory tumbled onward. Her mother thought it was an attack from Maeve, a vicious reminder of whatever debt she owed, to make them look vulnerable. In the hours afterward, as she'd lain in the ice-cold bath adjacent to her bedroom, she had used her fey ears to overhear her parents and their court, debating it from the sitting room of their suite. It had to be Maeve. No one else could do anything like that, or know that such a demonstration, in front of the King of Otterlin, who already loathed magic, would be detrimental. She did not want to talk, even once she was again capable of walking and speaking and acting like a princess. Insisting some normalcy might help. Her mother made her go to a tea the next afternoon with Prince Dorian, carefully guarded and monitored, with Adian sitting between them. And when Dorian's flawless manners faltered and he knocked over the teapot, spilling on her new dress, she'd made a good show of having Adian threaten to pummel him. But she didn't care about the prince, or the tea, or the dress. She could barely walk back to her room. And that night she dreamt of the maggot invading her mind, waking with screams and flames in her mouth. At dawn, her parents took her out of the castle, headed for their manor 2 days away. Their foreign visitors might have caused too much stress, the healer said. She suggested Lady Marian take her, but her parents insisted they go. Her uncle approved. The King of Otterlin, it seemed, would not stay in the castle with her magic running rampant, either. Adian remained in Orinth, her parents promising he would be sent for when she was settled again. But she knew it was for his safety. Lady Marian went with them, leaving her husband and Elide at the palace, for their safety, too. A monster. That was what she was. A monster who had to be contained and monitored. Her parents argued the first 2 nights at the manor, and Lady Marian kept her company, reading to her, brushing her hair, telling her stories of her home in Perranth. Marian had been a laundress in the palace from her childhood, but when Evelyn arrived, they had become friends, mostly because the princess had stained her new husband's favorite shirt with ink and wanted to get it cleaned before he noticed. Evelyn soon made Marian her lady-in-waiting, and then Lord Lochan had returned from a rotation on the southern border. Handsome Cal Lochan, who somehow became the dirtiest man in the castle and constantly needed Marian's advice on how to remove various stains, who one day asked a bastard-born servant to be his wife, and not just wife, but Lady of Perranth, the second-largest territory in Terrasen. 2 years later, she had borne him Elide, heir of Perranth. She loved Marian's stories, and it was those stories she clung to in the quiet and tension of the next few days, when winter still gripped the world and made the manor groan. The house was creaking in the brisk winds the night her mother walked into her bedroom, far less grand than the one in the palace, but still lovely. They only summered here, as the house was too drafty for winter and the roads too perilous. The fact that they'd come... Still not asleep, her mother asked. Lady Marian rose from beside the bed. After a few warm words, Marian left, smiling at them both. Her mother curled up on the mattress, drawing her in close. I'm sorry, her mother whispered under her head. For the nightmares had also been of drowning, of icy water closing over her head. I am so sorry, Fireheart. She buried her face in her mother's chest, savoring the warmth. Are you still frightened of sleeping? She nodded, clinging tighter. I have a gift, then? When she didn't move, her mother said, Don't you wish to see it? She shook her head. She didn't want a gift. But this will protect you from harm. This will keep you safe always. She lifted her head, to find her mother smiling as she removed the golden chain and heavy round medallion from beneath her nightgown and held it out to her. She looked at the amulet, then at her mother, eyes wide. The amulet of Orinth, the heirloom honored above all others of their house. Its round disc was the size of her palm, and on its cerulean front, a white stag had been carved of horn, horn gifted from the Lord of the Forest. Between his curling antlers was a burning crown of gold, the immortal star that watched over them and pointed the way home to Terrasen. She knew every inch of the amulet, had run her fingers over it countless times, and memorized the shape of the symbols etched into the back. Words in a strange language that no one could remember.
Father gave this to you when you were in Wendlin, to protect you.
The smile remained, and before that, his uncle gave it to him when he came of age. It is a gift meant to be given to people in our family, to those who need its guidance. She was too stunned to object, as her mother slipped the chain over her head and arranged the amulet down her front. It hung almost to her navel, a warm, heavy weight.
Never take it off. Never lose it.
Her mother kissed her brow.
Wear it, and know that you are loved, Fireheart, that you are safe, and it is the strength of this.
She placed a hand on her heart.
That matters. Wherever you go, Aelin,
she whispered,
no matter how far, this will lead you home.
She had lost the amulet of Orinth, lost it that very same night. She could not bear it. She tried begging the Vog princes to put her out of her misery and drain her into nothing, but she had no voice here. Hours after her mother had given her the amulet of Orinth, a storm had struck. It was a storm of unnatural darkness, and in it she felt that wriggling, horrific thing pushing against her mind again. Her parents remained unconscious along with everyone else in the manor, even though a strange smell coated the air. She had clutched the amulet to her chest when she awoke to the pure dark and the thunder, clutched it, and prayed to every god she knew. But the amulet had not given her strength or courage, and she had slunk to her parents' room, as black as her own, save for the window flapping in the gusting wind and rain. The rain had soaked everything, but they had to be exhausted from dealing with her, and from the anxiety they tried to hide. So she shut the window for them, and carefully crawled into their damp bed so that she did not wake them. They didn't reach for her, didn't ask what was wrong. And the bed was so cold, colder than her own, and reeking of copper and iron, and that scent that did not sit well with her. It was to that scent that she awoke when the maid screamed. Lady Marian rushed in, eyes wide but clear. She did not look at her dead friends, but went straight to the bed and leaned across Evelyn's corpse. The lady-in-waiting was small and delicately boned, but she somehow lifted her away from her parents, holding her tightly as she rushed from the room. The few servants at the manor were in a panic, some racing for help that was at least a day away, some fleeing. Lady Marian stayed. Marian stayed and drew a bath, helping her peel away the cold, bloody nightgown. They did not talk, did not try. Lady Marian bathed her, and when she was clean and dry, she carried her down to the cold kitchen. Marian sat her at the long table, bundled in a blanket, and set about building the hearth fire. She had not spoken today. There were no sounds or words left in her anyway. One of the few remaining servants burst in, shouting to the empty house that King Orlan was dead too. Murdered in his bed, just like. Lady Marian was out of the kitchen with her teeth bared before the man could enter. She didn't listen to gentle Marian slapping him, ordering him to get out and find help. Find real help and not useless news.
Murdered. Her family was dead. There was no coming back from death. And her parents. What had the servants done with their... there.
Shaking hit her so hard, the blanket tumbled away. She couldn't stop her teeth from clacking. It was a miracle she stayed in the chair. It couldn't be true. This was another nightmare, and she would awaken to her father stroking her hair, her mother smiling, awaken in Orinth, and... The warm weight of the blanket wrapped around her again, and Lady Marian scooped her into her lap, rocking.
I know. I'm not going to leave. I'm going to stay with you until help comes. They'll be here tomorrow. Lord Lochin, Captain Quinn, your Adian. They're all going to be here tomorrow. Maybe even by dawn.
But Lady Marian was shaking too.
I know,
she kept saying, weeping quietly.
I know.
The fire died down, along with Marion's crying. They held on to each other, rooted to that kitchen chair. They waited for the dawn, and for the others who would help somehow. A clopping issued from outside, faint, but the world was so silent that they heard the lone horse. It was still dark. Lady Marian scanned the kitchen windows, listening to the horse slowly circling, until... They were under the table in a flash, Marian pressing her into the freezing floor, covering her with her delicate body. The horse headed toward the darkened front of the house. The front, because the kitchen light might suggest to whoever it was that someone was inside. The front was better for sneaking in, to finish what had begun the night before.
Aelin?
Marian whispered, and small, strong hands found her face, forcing her to look at the whitest snow features, the blood-red lips.
Aelin, listen to me.
Though Marian was breathing quickly, her voice was even.
You are going to run for the river. Do you remember the way to the footbridge?
The narrow rope and wood bridge across the ravine, and the rushing river Florine below. She nodded.
Good girl. Make for the bridge and cross it. Do you remember the empty farm down the road? Find a place to hide there, and do not come out. Do not let yourself be seen by anyone except someone you recognize, not even if they say they're a friend. Wait for the court. They will find you.
She was shaking again, but Marian gripped her shoulders.
I am going to buy you what time I can, Aelin. No matter what you hear, no matter what you see, don't look back, and don't stop until you find a place to hide.
She shook her head, silent tears finding their way out at last. The front door groaned, a quick movement. Lady Marian reached for the dagger in her boot. It glinted in the dim light.
When I say run, you run, Aelin. Do you understand?
She didn't want to, not at all, but she nodded. Lady Marian brushed a kiss to her brow.
Tell my Elide.
Her voice broke.
Tell my Elide that I love her very much.
A soft thud of approaching footsteps from the front of the house. Lady Marian dragged her from under the table and eased open the kitchen door only wide enough for her to squeeze through.
Run.
Now, Lady Marian said, and shoved her into the night. The door shut behind her, and then there was only the cold, dark air and the trees that led toward the path to the bridge. She staggered into a run. Her legs were leaden, her bare feet tearing on the ground, but she made it to the trees, just as there was a crash from the house.
She gripped a trunk, her knees buckling. Through the open window, she could see Lady Marian standing before a hooded, towering man, her daggers out but trembling.
You will not find her!
The man said something that had Marian backing to the door, not to run, but to block it. She was so small, her nursemaid, so small against him.
She is a child,
Marian bellowed. She had never heard her scream like that, with rage and disgust and despair. Marian raised her daggers, precisely how her husband had shown her again and again. She should help, not cower in the trees. She had learned to hold a knife and a small sword. She should help. The man lunged for Marian, but she darted out of the way, and then leapt on him, slicing and tearing and biting. And then something broke. Something broke so fundamentally she knew there was no coming back from it, either for her or Lady Marian. As the man grabbed the woman and threw her against the edge of the table, a crack of bone, then the arc of his blade going for her stunned form, for her head. Red sprayed. She knew enough about death to understand that once a head was severed like that, it was over. Knew that Lady Marian, who had loved her husband and daughter so much, was gone. Knew that this was called sacrifice. She ran. Ran through the barren trees, the brush ripping her clothes, her hair, shredding and biting. The man didn't bother to be quiet as he flung open the kitchen door, mounted his horse, and galloped after her. The hoofbeats were so powerful they seemed to echo through the forest. The horse had to be a monster. She tripped over a root and slammed into the earth. In the distance, the melting river was roaring, so close, but her ankle gave a bolt of agony. Stuck. She was stuck in the mud and roots. She yanked at the roots that held her, wood ripping her nails, and when that did nothing, she clawed at the muddy ground. Her fingers burned. A sword whined as it was drawn from its sheath, and the ground reverberated with the pounding hooves of the horse. Closer. Closer it came. A sacrifice. It had been a sacrifice, and now it would be in vain. More than death, that was what she hated most. The wasted sacrifice of Lady Marian. She clawed at the ground and yanked at the roots, and then, tiny eyes in the dark, small fingers at the roots, heaving them up, up. Her foot slipped free, and she was up again, unable to thank the little folk who had already vanished, unable to do anything but run, limping now. The man was so close, the bracken cracking behind, but she knew the way. She had come through here so many times that the darkness was no obstacle. She only had to make it to the bridge. His horse could not pass, and she was fast enough to outrun him. The little folk might help her again. She only had to make it to the bridge. A break in the trees, and the river's roar grew overpowering. She was so close now. She felt and heard, rather than saw, his horse break through the trees behind her, the whoosh of his sword as he lifted it, preparing to cleave her head right there. There were the twin posts, faint on the moonless night. The bridge. She had made it, and now she only had yards, now a few feet, now. The breath of his horse was hot on her neck as she flung herself between the two posts of the bridge, making a leap onto the wooden planks, making a leap onto thin air. She had not missed it. No, those were the posts, and he had cut the bridge. It was her only thought as she plummeted. So fast she had no time to scream, before she hit the icy water and was pulled under. That
That moment, Lady Marian had chosen a desperate hope for her kingdom over herself, over her husband and the daughter who would wait and wait for a return that would never come. That was the moment that had broken everything Aelin Galathinius was and had promised to be. Selena was lying on the ground, on the bottom of the world, on the bottom of hell. That was the moment she could not face, had not faced. For even then, she had known the enormity of that sacrifice. There was more, after the moment she'd hit the water. But those memories were hazy, a mix of ice and black water and strange light. And then she knew nothing more until Aerobin was crouched over her on the reedy riverbank, somewhere far away. She awoke in a strange bed in a cold keep, the amulet of Orinth lost to the river. Whatever magic it had, whatever protection, had been used up that night. Then the process of taking her fear and guilt and despair and twisting them into something new. Then the hate that had rebuilt her, the rage that had fueled her, smothering the memories she buried in a grave within her heart and never let out. She had taken Lady Marian's sacrifice and become a monster, almost as bad as the one who had murdered Lady Marian and her own family. That was why she could not, did not, go home. She had never looked for the death tolls in those initial weeks of slaughter, or the years afterward. But she knew Lord Lochan had been executed, Quinn and his men, and so many of those children, such bright lights, all hers to protect. And she had failed. Selena clung to the ground. It was what she had not been able to tell Kaol or Dorian or Elena. That when Nehemia arranged for her own death so it would spur her into action, that sacrifice, that worthless sacrifice. She could not let go of the ground. There was nothing beneath it, nowhere else to go. Nowhere to outrun this truth. She didn't know how long she lay on the bottom of wherever this was. But eventually the Vog princes started up again, barely more than shadows of thought and malice, as they stalked from memory to memory, as if sampling platters at a feast. Little bites. Sips. They did not even look her way, for they had won, and she was glad of it. Let them do what they wanted. Let Narok carry her back to Otterlin and throw her at the king's feet. There was a scrape and crunch of shoes. Then a small, smooth hand slid toward her. But it was not Kaol or Sam or Nehemia who lay across from her, watching her with those sad turquoise eyes, her cheek against the moss, the young princess she had been. Aelin Galathinius reached a hand for her. "Get up," she said softly. Selena shook her head. Aelin strained for her, bridging that rift in the foundation of the world. "Get up." A promise. A promise for a better life, a better world. The Vog princes paused. She had wasted her life, wasted Marian's sacrifice. Those slaves had been butchered because she had failed, because she had not been there in time.
"Get up,"
someone said beyond the young princess. Sam. Sam, standing just beyond where she could see, smiling faintly.
"Get up,"
said another voice, a woman's. "Nehemia."
"Get up."
Two voices together, her mother and father, faces grave but eyes bright. Her uncle was beside them, the crown of Terrasen on his silver hair.
"Get up,"
he told her gently. One by one, Like shadows emerging from the mist, they appeared. The faces of the people she had loved with her heart of wildfire. And then there was Lady Marian, smiling beside her husband.
Get up,
she whispered, her voice full of that hope for the world, and for the daughter she would never see again. A tremor in the darkness. Aelin still lay before her, hand still reaching. The Vog princes turned. As the demon princes moved, her mother stepped toward her, face and hair and build so like her own.
You are a disappointment,
she hissed. Her father crossed his muscular arms.
You are everything I hated about the world.
Her uncle, still wearing the antler crown long since burned to ash.
Better that you had died with us than shame us, degrade our memory, betray our people.
Their voices swirled together.
Traitor, murderer, liar, thief, coward.
Again and again, worming in just as the King of Otterland's power had wriggled in her mind like a maggot. The king hadn't done it merely to cause a disruption and hurt her. He had also done it to separate her family, to get them out of the castle, to take the blame away from Otterlin and make it look like an outside attack. She had blamed herself for dragging them to the manor house to be butchered. But the king had planned it all, every minute detail. Except for the mistake of leaving her alive, perhaps because the power of the amulet did indeed save her.
Come with us,
her family whispered.
Come with us into the ageless dark.
They reached for her, faces shadowed and twisted. Yet even those faces, so warped with hatred, she still loved them, even if they loathed her, even if it ached. Loved them until their hissing faded, until they vanished like smoke, leaving only Aelin lying beside her, as she had been all along. She looked at Aelin's face, the face she'd worn once, and at her still outstretched hand, so small and unscarred. The darkness of the Vog princes flickered. There was solid ground beneath her. Moss and grass. Not hell. Earth. The earth on which her kingdom lay, green and mountainous and as unyielding as its people. Her people. Her people waiting for 10 years, but no longer. She could see the snow-capped staghorns, the wild tangle of Oakwald at their feet, and Orinth. That city of light and learning, once a pillar of strength, and her home. It would be both again. She would not let that light go out. She would fill the world with it, with her light, her gift. She would light up the darkness so brightly that all who were lost or wounded or broken would find their way to it. A beacon for those who still dwelled in that abyss. It would not take a monster to destroy a monster, but light. Light to drive out darkness. She was not afraid. She would remake the world, remake it for them, those she had loved with this glorious burning heart. A world so brilliant and prosperous that when she saw them again in the afterworld, she would not be ashamed. She would build it for her people, who had survived this long, and whom she would not abandon. She would make for them a kingdom such as there had never been, even if it took until her last breath. She was their queen, and she could offer them nothing less. Aelin Galathinius smiled at her, hand still outreached.
Get up,
the princess said. Selena reached across the earth between them and brushed her fingers against Aelin's. And arose.
Chapter 55. The barrier fell. But the darkness did not advance over the wardstones, and Rowan, who had been restrained by Gavriel and Lorkin in the grass outside the fortress, knew why. The creatures and Narok had captured a prize far greater than the Demi-Fay. The joy of feeding on her was something they planned to relish for a long, long while. Everything else was secondary, as if they'd forgotten to continue advancing, swept up in the frenzy of feasting. Behind them, the fighting continued, as it had for the past 20 minutes. Wind and ice were of no use against the darkness, though Rowan had hurled both against it the moment the barrier fell. Again and again, anything to pierce that eternal black and see what was left of the princess. Even as he started hearing a soft, warm female voice beckoning to him from the darkness. That voice he had spent centuries forgetting, which now tore him to shreds.
"Rowan?"
Gavriel murmured, tightening his grip on Rowan's arm. Rain had begun pouring.
"We are needed inside."
"No,"
he snarled. He knew Aelin was alive, because during all these weeks that they had been breathing each other's scents, they had become bonded. She was alive, but could be in any level of torment or decay. That was why Gavriel and Lorkin were holding him back. If they didn't, he would run for the darkness, where Lyria beckoned. But for Aelin, he had tried to break free.
"Rowan, the others!"
"No!"
Lorkin swore over the roar of the torrential rain.
"She is dead, you fool, or close enough to it. You can still save other lives."
They began hauling him to his feet, away from her.
"If you don't let me go, I'll rip your head from your body,"
he snarled at Lorkin. The commander who had offered him a company of warriors when he had nothing and no one left. Gavriel flicked his eyes to Lorkin in some silent conversation. Rowan tensed, preparing to fling them off. They would knock him unconscious sooner than allow him into that dark, where Lyria's beckoning had now turned to screaming for mercy.
"It wasn't real. It wasn't real."
But Aelin was real, and was being drained of life with every moment they held him here. All he needed to get them unconscious was for Gavriel to drop his magical shield, which he'd had up against Rowan's own power from the moment he'd pinned him. He had to get into that dark, had to find her.
"Let go,"
he growled again. A rumbling shook the earth, and they froze. Beneath them, some huge power was surging, a behemoth rising from the deep. They turned toward the darkness, and Rowan could have sworn that a golden light arced through it, then disappeared.
"That's impossible," Gavriel breathed. "She burned out."
Rowan didn't dare blink. Her burnouts had always been self-imposed, some inner barrier composed of fear and a lingering desire for normalcy that kept her from accepting the true depth of her power. The creatures fed on despair and pain and terror. But what if? What if the victim let go of those fears? What if the victim walked through them, embraced them? As if in answer, flame erupted from the wall of darkness. The fire unfurled, filling the rainy night, vibrant as a red opal. Lorkin swore, and Gavriel threw up additional shields of his own magic. Rowan didn't bother. They did not fight him as he shrugged off their grip, surging to his feet. The flame didn't singe a hair on his head. It flowed above and past him, glorious and immortal and unbreakable. And there, beyond the stones, standing between two of those creatures, was Aelin, a strange mark glowing on her brow. Her hair flowed around her, shorter now and bright like her fire. And her eyes, though they were red-rimmed, the gold in her eyes was a living flame. The two creatures lunged for her, the darkness sweeping in around them.
Rowan ran all of one step before she flung out her arms, grabbing the creatures by their flawless faces, her palms over their open mouths as she exhaled sharply. As if she'd breathed fire into their cores, flames shot out of their eyes, their ears, their fingers. The two creatures didn't have a chance to scream as she burned them into cinders. She lowered her arms. Her magic was raging so fiercely that the rain turned to steam before it hit her. A weapon bright from the forging. He forgot Gavriel and Lorcan as he bolted for her. The gold and red and blue flames utterly hers, this air of fire. Spying him at last, she smiled faintly. A queen's smile. But there was exhaustion in that smile, and her bright magic flickered. Behind her, Narok and the remaining creature, the one they had faced in the woods, were spooling the darkness into themselves, as if readying for attack. She turned toward them, swaying slightly, her skin deathly pale. They had fed on her, and she was drained after shredding apart their brethren. A very real, very final burnout was steadily approaching. The wall of black swelled, one final hammer blow to squash her. But she stood fast, a golden light in the darkness. That was all Rowan needed to see before he knew what he had to do. Wind and ice were of no use here, but there were other ways. Rowan drew his dagger and sliced his palm open as he sprinted through the gate stones. The darkness built and built, and she knew it would hurt, knew it would likely kill her and Rowan when it came crashing down. But she would not run from it. Rowan reached her, panting and bloody. She did not dishonor him by asking him to flee as he extended his bleeding palm, offering his raw power to harness now that she was well and truly emptied. She knew it would work. She had suspected it for some time now. They were Karanam. He had come for her. She held his gaze as she grabbed her own dagger and cut her palm, right over the scar she'd given herself at Nehemia's grave. And though she knew he could read the words on her face, she said, "To whatever end?" He nodded, and she joined hands with him, blood to blood and soul to soul, his other arm coming around to grip her tightly. Their hands clasped between them, he whispered into her ear, "I claim you too, Aelin Galathinius." The wave of impenetrable black descended, roaring as it made to devour them. Yet this was not the end. This was not her end. She had survived loss and pain and torture. She had survived slavery and hatred and despair. She would survive this, too. Because hers was not a story of darkness. So she was not afraid of that crushing black, not with the warrior holding her, not with the courage that having one true friend offered, a friend who made living not so awful after all. Not if she were with him. Rowan's magic punched into her, old and strange and so vast her knees buckled. He held her with that unrelenting strength, and she harnessed his wild power as he opened his innermost barriers, letting it flow through her. The black wave was not halfway fallen when they shattered it apart with golden light, leaving Narok and his remaining prince gaping. She did not give them a moment to spool the darkness back. Drawing power from the endless well within Rowan, she pulled up fire and light, embers and warmth, the glow of a thousand dawns and sunsets. If the Volg craved the sunshine of Aurelia, then she would give it to them. Narok and the prince were shrieking. The Volg did not want to go back. They did not want to be ended, not after spending so long waiting to return to her world. But she crammed the light down their throats, burning up their black blood. She clung to Rowan, gritting her teeth against the sounds.
There was a sudden silence, and she looked to Narok, standing so still, watching, waiting. A spear of black punched into her head, offering one more vision in a mere heartbeat. Not a memory, but a glimpse of the future. The sounds and smell and look of it were so real that only her grip on Rowan kept her anchored in the world. Then it was gone, and the light was still building, enveloping them all. The light became unbearable as she willed it into the two Vog who had now dropped to their knees, pouring it into every shadowy corner of them. And she could have sworn that the blackness in Narok's eyes faded. Could have sworn that his eyes became a mortal brown, and that gratitude flickered just for a moment. Just for a moment. Then she burned both demon and Narok to ash. The remaining Vog prince crawled only 2 steps before he followed suit, a silent scream on his perfect face as he was incinerated. When the light and flames receded, all that remained of Narok and the Vog were 4 wordstone collars, steaming in the wet grass. Chapter 56. A few days after the unforgivable, despicable slave massacre, Sorsha was finishing up a letter to her friend when there was a knock on her workroom door. She jumped, scrawling a line of ink down the center of the page. Dorian popped his head in, grinning, but the grin faltered when he saw the letter.
"I hope I'm not interrupting,"
he said, slipping in and shutting the door. As he turned, she balled up the ruined paper and chucked it into the rubbish pail. "Not at all," she said, toes curling as he nuzzled her neck and slipped his arms around her waist. "Someone might walk in," she protested, squirming out of his grip. He let her go, but his eyes gleamed in a way that told her when they were alone again tonight, he might not be so easy to convince. She smiled.
"Do that again," he breathed.
So Sorsha smiled again, laughing. And he looked so baffled by it that she asked, "What?"
"That's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen,"
he said. She had to look away, go find something to do with her hands. They worked together in silence, as they were prone to doing now that Dorian knew his way around the workroom. He liked helping her with her tonics for other patients. Someone coughed from the doorway, and they straightened, Sorsha's heart flying into her throat. She hadn't even noticed the door opening, or the captain of the guard now standing in it. The captain walked right in, and Dorian stiffened beside her.
"Captain," she said, "are you in need of my assistance?"
Dorian said nothing, his face unusually grim, those beautiful eyes haunted and heavy. He slipped a warm hand around her waist, resting it on her back. The captain quietly shut the door and seemed to listen to the outside hall for a moment before speaking. He looked even graver than her prince, his broad shoulders seeming to sag under an invisible burden. But his golden brown eyes were clear as they met Dorian's.
"You were right."
Kaol supposed it was a miracle in itself that Dorian had agreed to do this. The grief on Dorian's face this morning had told him he could ask, and that Dorian would say yes. Dorian made Kaol explain everything to both of them. That was Dorian's price, the truth owed to him, and to the woman who deserved to know what she was risking herself for. Kaol quietly, quickly, explained everything. The magic, the word keys, the 3 towers, all of it. To her credit, Sorsha didn't fall apart or doubt him. He wondered if she was reeling, if she was upset with Dorian for not telling her. She revealed nothing,
not with that healer's training and self-control. But the prince watched Sorsha as if he could read her impregnable mask and see what was brewing beneath. The prince had somewhere to be. He kissed Sorsha before he left, murmuring something into her ear that made her smile. Kaol hadn't suspected to find Dorian so happy with his healer. Sorsha. It was an embarrassment that Kaol had never known her name until today. And from the way Dorian looked at her, and she him, he was glad that his friend had found her. When Dorian had gone, Sorsha was still smiling, despite what she'd learned. It made her truly stunning. It made her whole face open up.
I think,
Kaol said. And Sorsha turned, brows high, ready to get to work.
I think,
he said again, smiling faintly,
that this kingdom could use a healer as its queen.
She did not smile at him, as he'd hoped. Instead, she looked unfathomably sad as she returned to her work. Kaol left without further word to ready himself for his experiment with Dorian, the only person in this castle, perhaps in the world, who could help him. Help them all. Dorian had raw power, Selena had said, power to be shaped as he willed it. That was the only thing similar enough to the power of the word keys, neither good nor evil. And crystals, Kaol had once read in Selena's magic books, were good conduits for magic. It hadn't been hard to buy several from the market, each about as long as his finger, white as fresh snow. Everything was nearly ready when Dorian finally arrived in one of the secret tunnels and took a seat on the ground. Candles burned around them, and Kaol explained his plan as he finished pouring the last line of red sand from the red desert, the merchant had claimed, between the three crystals. Equidistant from one another, they made the shape Murtagh had drawn on the map of their continent. In the center of the triangle sat a small bowl of water. Dorian pinned him with a stare.
Don't blame me if they shatter. I have replacements.
He did. He'd bought a dozen crystals. Dorian stared at the first crystal.
You just want me to focus my power on it? Then draw a line of power to the next crystal, then the next, imagining that your goal is to freeze the water in the bowl. That's all.
A raised brow.
That's not even a spell. Just humor me,
Kaol said.
I wouldn't have asked if this wasn't the only way.
He dipped a finger in the bowl of water, setting it rippling. Something in his gut said that maybe the spell required nothing more than power and sheer will. The prince's sigh filled the stone hall, echoing off the stones and vaulted ceiling. Dorian gazed at the first crystal, roughly representing Rifthold. For minutes, there was nothing. But then Dorian began sweating, swallowing repeatedly.
I'm fine,
Dorian gasped, and the first crystal began to glow white. The light grew brighter, Dorian sweating and grunting as if he were in pain. Kaol was about to ask him to stop when a line shot toward the next crystal. So fast it was nearly undetectable save for the slight ripple in the sand. The crystal flashed bright, and then another line shot out, heading south. Again, the sand rippled in its wake. The water remained fluid. The third crystal glowed, and the final line completed the triangle, making all three crystals flash for a moment. And then, slowly, crackling softly, the water froze. Kaol shoved back against his horror and awe at how much Dorian's control had grown. Dorian's skin was pasty and gleamed with sweat.
This is how he did it. isn't it?
Kaol nodded.
10 years ago, with those three towers. They were all built years before so that this could happen precisely when his invading forces were ready, so no one could strike back. Your father's spell must be far more complex to have frozen magic entirely. But on a basic level, this is probably similar to what occurred.
I want to see where they are. The towers. Kaol shook his head, but Dorian said, You've told me everything else already. Show me the damn map. With a wipe of his hand, a god destroying a world, Dorian knocked down a crystal, releasing the power. The ice melted, the water rippling and sloshing against the bowl. Just like that. Kaol blinked. If they could knock out one tower, it was such a risk. They needed to be sure before acting. Kaol pulled out the map Murtaug had marked, the map he didn't dare to leave anywhere.
Here, here, and here,
he said, pointing to Rifthold, Emeroth, and Knoll.
That's where we know towers were built. Watchtowers. But all three had the same traits. Black stone, gargoyles.
You mean to tell me that the clock tower in the garden is one of them?
Kaol nodded, ignoring the laugh of disbelief.
That's what we think.
The prince leaned over the map, bracing a hand against the floor. He traced a line from Rifthold to Emeroth, then from Rifthold to Knoll. The northward line cuts through the Farian Gap. The southern cuts directly through Morath. You told Adian that you thought my father had sent Roland and Caltaine to Morath, along with any other nobles with magic in their blood. What are the odds that it's a mere coincidence?
And the Farian Gap.
Kaol had to swallow.
Selena said she'd heard of wings in the gap. Nehemia said her scouts did not come back, that something was brewing there.
Two spots for him to breed whatever army he's making, perhaps drawing on this power as it makes a current through them.
Three.
Kaol pointed to the Dead Islands.
We had a report that something strange was being bred there, and that it's been sent to Wendlin.
But my father sent Selena. The prince swore.
There's no way to warn them?
We've already tried.
Dorian wiped the sweat from his brow.
So you're working with them? You're on their side? No. I don't know. We just share information. But this is all information that helps us. You.
Dorian's eyes hardened, and Kaol winced as a cool breeze swept in.
So what are you going to do?
Dorian asked.
Just knock down the clock tower?
Destroying the clock tower was an act of war, an act that could endanger the lives of too many people. There would be no going back. He didn't even want to tell Adian or Wren for fear of what they'd do. They wouldn't think twice before incinerating it, perhaps killing everyone in this castle in the process.
I don't know. I don't know what to do.